Welcome to the Mud Island Adventures podcast. I'm your host, Garrick McMullen, and I'm here to help you find your adventure right here in the UK. Good evening. Welcome back. It is time for another episode of the Mud Island Adventures podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Lee. How are you doing this evening, mate?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right. We're doing this tonight a little bit earlier than we usually do it. So today is June the 8th, and it is World Ocean Day, which those of you that follow on the Instagram and the Facebook group, we've had some lovely, lovely photos, people sharing stories about why the ocean is so important to them today, and it's been fantastic. Oh, we've got the dogs. Who let the dogs out? Anyway.
Sick 'em, boy. So, sick 'em.
So, apart from that, we're doing this a bit early because I've got a prior engagement on Thursday evening, and this weekend is going to be busy. So, myself and a friend of mine, we are going to do the King Alfred's Way this weekend, which is 350k route around Wessex. On bicycles. So it's a gravel route. It's been created by Cycling England or Cycling UK. And essentially, yeah, if we're going to go in wild camp and have a big adventure on what is probably going to be the hottest weekend of the year so far. So, yay, go us.
Good planning.
Yeah. Well, part of it is planning. So part of it is preparation for the Triple Challenge 21 coming up in September. Yes. So we'll be doing lots of photos and figuring out some of the eastern side of the route, which will be part of the challenge. So again, if you haven't seen the details of that, please go to the Just Giving page for Mud Island Adventures Triple Challenge 21 and have a read of what we're doing and why. And if you're feeling a bit flush and you like what we're doing, how about making a donation? All donations are greatly received. More great news this week, Lee. We smashed. Well, I say smashed. We've hit the 200 members barrier on the Facebook group. We're currently sat at 203. So thank you, everyone that shared and put the word out there to get that number up to 200 plus. So, but you know, are we going to settle for that?
No, we're not.
No. So, you know, please let's keep the sharing going. Tell all your friends. Excellent stuff. So, as always, we're on the Facebook group, Mud Island Adventures. You can follow the page at Mud Island Adventures and Training or at Mud Island Adventures on Instagram. We're also on Twitter. Guess what? Mud Island Adventures. Yeah, YouTube is coming soon. So please keep your eyes open. You've already found this podcast and we thank you for listening. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a review. That's how we get the numbers up. So if you can give us a great review. If you don't like what we're doing, let us know why. All criticism is received when in the nature to which it's given. Lee, it's a wet week, so World Ocean Day today.
Absolutely.
So today we're going to, our sort of main topic is going to be, as per the poll on the Facebook group, it was a landslide victory for stand-up paddleboarding.
Sup. Yeah, stand-up paddleboarding, awesome stuff.
Yeah. So, Those who know anything about board sports in general, most of them started in Hawaii or somewhere in Polynesia, and stand-up paddleboarding is no different. Again, same as surfing, developed in the sort of South Pacific and the Polynesian Islands. But it's evolved over the years and become a prominent sport amongst watermen and women. And you can now go surfing, there's racing, marathon and sprint, there's you know, some epic adventures that have been done on stand-up puddle boards over the years. You know, there's I've got friends up in Wales who are white water paddleboarding.
Oh, really?
Which I've got to be honest, I've not tried that yet, but it sounds epic. I might give that a go.
Yeah.
And stand up paddleboarding last year, so during the lockdown, absolutely exploded. I think it was the fastest growing or the largest growing sport in the UK. Certainly during 2020, Red Paddle Company, one of the biggest stand-up paddleboard companies in the UK at least, reported a 300% increase in sales for 2020, which just goes to show how popular it became last year. So we're not alone. There's something like 900,000 paddlers out there, which is, you know, makes it a huge, huge sport. And we're going to let you know, we're going to give you a little insight into how to get involved if it's something you fancy trying but haven't quite known how to go about it. So here we go. I'm going to start off with equipment lead because I think that's probably the biggest question on everybody's lips. Where or what do I need to do this? So same as we've alluded to in a couple of the other activities that we've covered. You can hire the equipment. You can go and find them. We did this a few years ago, didn't we? Sort of got together.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Down at Boscombe.
You, I, and Mark. We went down to Boscombe. We picked up some kit. We got out on the water there. It's a lovely little day. Hmm. Just playing about on the water.
And then for a relatively sort of small price, you know, you can hire the equipment from. You know, find a reputable one. Make sure the equipment's not falling apart when you do it. But yeah, you know, if you want to just give it a go. And that was certainly how when I first did paddleboarding, I was down in Kingsbridge in Devon.
Lovely.
With a guy who runs Kingsbridge stand-up paddleboarding, K-Sub. And he took us down the Dart Estuary, which was an amazing trip. And Joe and I were both hooked from that point. It was only a matter of time before we started or we got our own equipment. So when we eventually took the plunge into buying our own paddle boards, we thought, well, what's the easiest way to do it? And there's so many different types of board that you can buy. The first thing that you probably want to check out is, or think about what form of paddleboarding you're likely to do. Now, you can spend a lot of money on boards, and that's fine. You know, obviously it's your money. Spend what you want. We don't care. Nope. But what I would say is make sure that when you buy your first board, don't buy a rubbish one. Okay. Over the last year or so, with the increase in the amount of paddleboards being sold, there are some really horrible cheap knockoffs that have come onto the market that just aren't worth and probably aren't safe to use, to be fair. And certainly won't support what you want to do. And quite often that can ruin your experience of paddleboarding. And I know a couple of people who have said, this is rubbish. You know, I'm not getting anywhere with it. Well, that's because you paid £150 from some Chinese website to do it. So
no,
it is worth spending a bit of cash.
No, it absolutely is. And, you know, that little bit of extra money that you sort of put out there, that is going to make the world a difference to your enjoyment. And that's the same as any of the activities that we talk about. But for paddleboarding and stuff, you know, there's the board itself, there's the paddle, and those leashes. Now, watching something the other day, and they're getting these new leashes, which are like a quick release or something, I think.
Yeah, so, you see those? Well, when you're looking at a lot of the packages that are being offered now, so I think I paid about £300 each for our first boards, and they're inflatable boards, so you can get solid boards, you can have inflatable boards, and they take up to about sort of somewhere around 17, 16, 17 PSI, which is quite a lot when you're trying to pump that up yourself. But the reason for that is it needs to be fairly rigid as you're paddling it. And you can buy a package. So with the package that I got, I got a good board. I did the research on it, looked at the reviews, reputable company. And with that, I got a paddle, a pump, a leash, and a little sort of roll-top waterproof bag. So actually pretty good deal for the money we spent, particularly when you're buying two, obviously, when, you know, it can get a little bit expensive. But the thing with the leashes, and I'll go into this, it's quite an important one. You and I were used to putting a leash around our ankle or you know, your sort of upper calf if you want.
Yeah, longboard, yeah. If you on the back foot, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas with, and you can do that, if you're paddling out on the sea, yeah, absolutely, why not? Or on a lake. But on flowing water, one of the key safety points that people have, or that, you know, the people who know have developed, is to attach it to a belt around your waist rather than around your ankle.
Okay.
Which, yeah, so you can have a look at this. People have sort of posted videos on YouTube, and they've demonstrated in a safety environment why. And the reason is that if you are attached by the foot and your leash gets caught around something submerged or a branch or whatever in the water, that the water flow can actually drag you down by your ankle. Whereas if it's at your waist, you'll be held up above it. That, you know, this is provided you're wearing the correct buoyancy aid, etc.
And can I just throw in there as well, Gary? I'm going to guess that also it's a lot easier to access, you know, when it's at your waist rather than around your ankle.
Yeah, correct.
Is that part of it? Yeah,
That is part of it, actually. Yeah, so actually trying to release that leash whilst you're, you know, attached by the foot and getting dragged under is probably not a great thing. So, of course, the quick release part of it is another addition to that that's come along. So if you do get put in that position where you can't free yourself, you can just release the strap and at least you'll float away. Yeah. So there you go. That's that point. So again, you know, once you've had a go at stand-up paddleboarding, you've looked towards where you want to go, you can then go down the route of specializing in the equipment that you want, whether that be a surfing SUP or a racing SUP, you know, or just something for touring. And nowadays, you can pick up some really good kit secondhand. There's a lot of people selling secondhand. Get some advice on it. That's my advice. But you know, if you're not sure, there's loads of Facebook groups now that will help out with this stuff. And occasionally, you know, people will ask the same questions over and over again. It's like a lot of Facebook sort of sites, but you know. Go and ask the questions anyway. There's no harm at all. And if people are nice, then they'll answer the questions regardless of how many times it's been asked. Or at least they'll point you in the right direction.
Exactly, yeah.
So buoyancy aids, I can't stress enough. Now, I don't, admittedly, if I'm attempting to surf myself, it's a beast. And it takes, it's like trying to surf the QE2 is massive. or compared to a shortboard, certainly. But I don't tend to wear a buoyancy aid then, because it, you know, sort of encumbers what I'm doing. And I'm used to, you know, as an experienced surfer, I'm used to recovering myself if I fall off a surfboard. Not an issue. If you're not quite such a, you know, if you're not a strong swimmer, you're not as confident in the water, absolutely, by all means, you know, wear the buoyancy aid in the sea. But what I would say is, if you are on inland water, absolutely recommend wearing a buoyancy aid. And that's simply because if you fall off a a board in the sea, the chances are that you're not going to hit your head. You know, it's advisable to fall backwards when you go off the board or to the side. But if you are inland, it's not always possible to know what is underneath the surface. So, you know, a bump on the head that can... I had an incident a little while ago where I was kayaking. And I hadn't kayaked for a while. That, you know, that's beside the point. But I ended up capsizing. And as I went over, literally just smacks the front of my head. Fortunately, I was wearing a helmet at the time.
Yeah.
You know, smacked my head, and it, you know, with quite some force, enough to give me a mild concussion that I knew about for a couple of days afterwards.
Oof, yeah.
But had that knocked me out, and I'd, you know, if I'd not been wearing a buoyancy aid at the time, who knows what, you know, what might have happened. So just in case, I always think it's worth wearing a buoyancy aid rather than not wearing one.
No, when absolutely. Absolutely. It's when it comes to, you know, any of these activities, you know, we'd always recommend that, you know, you start off within your comfort zone, and then to start to expand. And as your experience builds, then you can decide what pieces of equipment or what bits of kit you need or don't need. But always sort of err on the side of caution when we start with this stuff. Better to have fun.
Absolutely. Expand. Yeah. The key point with a buoyancy aid is make sure you've got one that is the right weight range for you. So too much and it, you know, can flip you over when you go in, or if it's not supportive enough, it just won't support you, particularly in moving water. So helmets, that's a personal thing. And I to be fair, I don't wear a helmet when I'm paddling day to day. However, if I was going to go and spend some time up in Wales with my buddy and do some whitewater paddling, I would absolutely be wearing, you know, a good helmet. You know, I've seen pictures of him. He's in full dry, sort of paddling dry suit and knee pads and all sorts. So,
oh boy,
that's what they've got in the water up there. so again, you know, not particularly necessary unless you're doing some crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So the next thing is you've got all your gear. And what do you need to know next? Well, where can I take this and go paddling and have fun? I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You can obviously paddle on the sea. There's rivers, canals, lakes dotted all around this beautiful country of ours. Unfortunately, about 95% of our inland waterways are owned by somebody, which means that, you know, you either have to have permission to paddle on it, or if it's maintained by the inland waterways people, then you need a license to paddle on it.
Of course.
Not so for you guys up there in Scotland. You lucky buggers, because you've got the right to roam. So
yes,
but even then, I would check to make sure that you're in the right every time. Now,
just to jump onto that one, that there are certain places. I don't know whether this applies to paddle boards, but if you are launching boats on some of the locks and the rivers, then yes, you will need a permit of some description. But again, that's something that you need to check with wherever you're going to go, and it's obviously better to do that ahead of it rather than turn up and go, oh, I do not have my piece of way to that. So yeah, just a bit of forward planning there, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, like with all adventures, you know,
yeah,
a bit of planning, it's all part of the fun.
So
for Wales and England, essentially what we're what I'd advise is that you join British canoeing. Now, British canoeing seem to be taking care of most of the paddle sports, particularly on the inland waterways. And they will be able to advise on the website, which is www.britishcanoeing.org.uk. And they can advise on where you can and cannot paddle, whichever, you know, sort of form of watercraft, paddlecraft that you're using. They will also, by joining British canoeing, that covers you for most of the inland waterways. Less a few, but that's specified on the website. So certainly for most of the canals and the big rivers, that takes care of your licensing issues. On top of that, you may want some training. Now, there's a growing number of instructors. Obviously, the need for instructors has significantly grown. Not to say that you have to go and get instruction, but some people react better to it and just want that little bit of confidence of having had professional instruction. And if you're looking for a school, if you go to www.bsupa, so that's bsupa.org.uk, and that is the British Stand-Up Paddleboarding Association website. And they sort of tend to lend support to the sports events, you know, around the country, and also advise on training. They're kind of the de facto governing body for training in stand-up paddleboarding. So well worth a visit. I must admit, I've not had any... I do all my own stunts, and I've not had any training.
I can attest to this. Yes, he does.
I've got advice from other people, and I've watched a lot of YouTube videos. You know, and I'm through sort of board sports in the past, whether it's from skateboarding, surfing, wakeboarding, whatever. You know, I've managed to transfer a lot of that skill set across to stand-up paddleboarding. Where the differences are is the paddle technique. So transferring from kayak and canoeing into stand-up paddleboarding, it doesn't quite translate in terms of the paddle stroke. So if you are a canoeist thinking, hey, I can go and do that, that's no problem, it's not quite the same. So just have a look, either get some training or have a look at YouTube for paddle techniques. The most important thing we've already touched on a little bit is the water safety. So we've already discussed the safety elements to do with inland waterways and potential snag hazards for leashes. But Lee, you're a former beach lifeguard.
Yes.
So who better to give some advice on what to look out for in the sea?
Okay, so when you arrive at the beach, especially in the summer, there will be a very large sign, and this sign will give you the information that you need in terms of what the coloured flags mean. So red and yellow flags is the bathing area. Black and white checkered flags is the surf. Or you can do what a lot of people do and just ignore both and do what you want, because that's what happens on almost every beach. But if you are going to follow that guidance, you do need to understand that in the sea, we have tides, we have currents, we have rip currents, and all of these things can affect your ability to either get out there or, more importantly, get back. The way that rip currents work, essentially, is that there is a difference in the depth between the water. And you can see this as you're looking out. You can see where the wave breaks and the foamy stuff on the top, it's just different. It just forms out and there's like a channel seawards. That's the rips. So that will take you out the back, and that's great. But if you do find yourself caught in those, you've got to understand that they are very powerful. They have the potential to take you way out of where you want to be, and therefore should be avoided. If you do find yourself in one, it's always best to paddle out at, you know, about a 45 degree angle. Don't try and fight it. Just trying to go with it, but move away from it at a 45 degree angle. Garrick's mentioned about, you know, it's a lot safer to come off the board. Yes, of course it is. But and what the waves are doing, you need to understand that, you know, some of that water can be a lot shallower and or a lot deeper than you might think. So it's a good idea to speak to the lifeguards who are on duty at the beach, or the local surf instructors, or the local surfers or swimmers, or whoever else might use that on a regular basis, especially if you're going into more remote areas without those without that lifeguard cover.
I've got to say, over the years that I've now as I've hit middle age, I've learnt to ignore the inner man. We're renowned for not asking directions, but actually, whenever I go somewhere new, regardless of what I'm doing, whether it's mountain biking, when it was paragliding, when it was surfing, whatever, I will now try and find a local and get a bit of insider knowledge, because I think that is, that's gold dust. Absolutely.
It really is. And, there's no one's going to tear up your man card. Nobody's going to step on your shoe. It really is about getting out there, having the fun, and coming back again to do it all again another day. So with the tides, you'll be able to pick up sort of tide tables from any sort of local environment around there. Most of the shops will sell. You can also download various apps, and they will tell you what the tides are doing, whether they're coming in, whether they're going out, and what the tidal reach will be. Now, the tidal reach is the difference between the high and the low tides, and that is determined by the lunar activity, relationship to the moon. So it's a whole big sort of complex thing, but it comes down to, is the water going out or is it coming in? And that's going to affect whether or not you have the ability to get around the headland or into there and get back again safely within a certain amount of time. It's usually about a 6-hour window. 6 to 7 hour window in between the changing of the tides. So this is something that you need to know. It's something that you need to be aware of, familiarize as to whatever your local environment is. But yeah, always when you come down to the beach, take a look around, find someone who really knows what they're doing, clearly looks like they live there. And, honestly, they will be any knowledge with you as well, because we're all in this together to get out there and have fun, and people are more than happy to help, but always.
Totally. And just one more thing on beach safety, or when you're paddling in the sea, something that we never used to take into consideration as surfers, but stand-up paddle boarders, you have to consider what the wind is doing. Now, on a nice, warm, sunny day, the chances are that the wind is going to be onshore because the sea breeze effect kicks in. But it's always worth looking at the meteor winds around you and try and figure out what's going on. When you don't want to be paddling is in a strong offshore breeze, because it will become harder to fight against that. So the worst combination you're looking at is an outgoing tide with an offshore breeze. You're going to become tired very quickly, and that's not going to be good.
No, so, basically, if that does happen, make sure you've got your passport in a waterproof bag.
More importantly, you've got your phone in a waterproof case. I always paddle with a phone, simply because if I do get into difficulty, then I'm not going to call Ghostbusters, but I'll get a hold of the RNLI in some form.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, the thing to remember, though, we've talked a lot about the safety here, because I think there's, it's worth highlighting that, as with a lot of the stuff we do, there are dangers involved. But with the right information, you can have amazing opportunities for adventure for all the family. And, it's great stuff. Joe and I go out paddling, and I have the boy sat on the front of the board, and we have amazing days out. So, it's well worth a go. Talking about amazing adventures, we've got a really big one this week, haven't we, Lee?
Oh, yes. For this week's big adventure, I have got to give you some historical context. I've just got to. All right. So, if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin. Way back in 1940, following the evacuation at Dunkirk as the Battle of Britain raged in the skies over southern England. In the Highlands of Scotland, an elite cadre of instructors were formed at Achnacarry House. Just outside of Fort William, near the small village of Speen Bridge, these instructors were tasked with being able to outperform any candidate that they would come into contact with during the course of this hazardous and very arduous training. When the candidates arrived at the Speen Bridge railway station, having volunteered from all branches and cap badges across the army, they would be met by this training team and given their very first test. That test was 7 miles in full battle gear, weighing around 30 pounds. If they completed it in 90 minutes or less, then they would continue their training. And those men would become the original commando forces that so incensed the Nazi hierarchy, they would not be taken as prisoners of war. Instead, they would be shot as spies. Today, over 80 years later, the commandos are at the forefront of the British amphibious operations. And so that spirit of arduous training, cheerfulness in the face of adversity and going where other people don't want them to go or think that they should be is still very much a part of that. So last year, there were 4 guys from the Commando Logistics Regiment down in Barnstable who decided that they were going to set up an event, but not just any event, because they are commandos. So they have to go a little bit more and do something a little bit extra. They decided that they were going to start at the present day Commando Training Centre in Limpston in Devon, starting with the 9 mile speed, the very first of the modern commando tests, which takes place down there. It's 90 minutes. You carry 10 kilograms of weight in your webbing and another about 6.5-7 kgs of rifle. So they did that and then they continued for 5 weeks, carrying 44-pound Bergens as they made their way from Devon up through England and Wales, crossing the border into Scotland and all the way to that original commando training site at where on the 6th of June, which is a very significant date, so do you who have been looking across the internet and various other media will know that that 6th of June 1944 is the anniversary of the original D-Day landings, for which the commandos were one of the spearhead. So Speen Bridge 624 completed 624 miles, averaging 20 miles a day, every day for 5 weeks. They set out to raise £1 in charity money, Marines Charity, and also for the NHS. And by the 5th of June, they had not met that target. They had, in fact, exceeded it. They, as I checked earlier, over £11,500 for those charities.
Amazing stuff.
Now, we had the opportunity. I reached out to them as they crossed the Scottish border a little while ago. We're still about 140 miles to go. We met them up in Lanark as they left there that morning. You can see that little interview with Mikey, Rob and Luke. IGTV at Driftwood 721. You can find it on the Mud Island Adventures training and page. So have a look at that. Take a look at what they've done. And also, I would ask you, if you are feeling strong, if you are feeling ambitious, take a look at their roots on Strava. Maybe you don't want to start out with a full 45 Bergen, but maybe you might just want to do that route. See how long it takes you and how you measure up to these men. Because it is a remarkable achievement to cover that amount of time or cover that amount of distance in that amount of time. And the fundraising, absolutely incredible. Absolutely brilliant. Hoofing effort, lads. Bravo, Zulu.
Just absolutely blown away by the tenacity of what they've achieved. I mean, it's we've been following it very closely during the whole journey.
Yeah.
And you know what? It just to keep going for 5 weeks, doing that day after day. It's, you know, yeah. Chapeau, guys. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, the amount of time that I spent in the Navy, not much, but I spent a lot of it working with the Royal Marines and the Commando Forces, so I've got a lot of respect for them. And I know that, Garrick, you've also worked with the Commandos in your role as well.
Yeah. Nice bunch of dudes as well.
They really are.
There we go. Okay. So, I mean, that's an amazing effort, but something a little more manageable. Not so manageable. Speaking of really massive efforts, apparently so, yeah, but only one man's done it. Tell us all about it.
Okay, so every so often we come up against some barrier that the experts or science or somebody else tells you cannot be passed. Right, because it was impossible for someone to swim the English until Royal Naval Captain Matthew Webb said, "Hold my port," in 1875, and swam the 21 miles from Dover to. He also said it was impossible to climb the world's highest mountain until Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay completed that in 1953. Then somebody said, "It can't be done. You cannot run a mile in less than 4 minutes. You can't do it." Dr. Roger Bannister in 1954. And so, when someone said that they're going to swim around the UK, the entire coast of the United Kingdom, every sports scientist, every professional swimmer, all the media, everybody said, "Nope, it's impossible. You will not do it." Ross Edgley said, "No, watch me." He spent 157 days at sea. He swam in stints working with the tide. 1,780 miles. He consumed somewhere between 10 and 15,000 calories a day. And he managed to complete this journey 7 days with the support crew on this catamaran. No point between him leaving Margate and returning to it did his feet touch dry land. He was either in the water or he was on the boat. Now, this is just remarkable. For someone to swim around the entire island is just incredible. I mean, how he did that, this is what the book is all about. The Art of Resilience by Ross Edgley details this journey. It talks about his training. It talks adaptation to this environment. And it also talks about what he calls strategic stress management. That is the rest and recovery and refueling to increase the body's adaptation to this stimuli of specific training. So to increase your tolerance and be able to basically do anything and become a durable human being with incredible work capacity. So it's an adventure. Yes. It's also an insight into the mindset and the training of what it takes to achieve what everyone else turns around and says, it's not possible. And as Ross Edgley says, to achieve the impossible, you have to walk your own path and write your own plan. And that is exactly what he did. The Art of Resilience by Ross Edgley is the second book in his little trilogy there. The next one, Blueprint, which I'm looking forward to, how he rebuilt himself after this extremely arduous swim and all of all of the adaptations that he had to then undo to from becoming this aquatic creature that basically swam 12 hours a day to return to a land-dwelling being. So that's the next book which I'm really looking forward to reading. But yeah, so Art of Resilience by Ross Edgeley is this week's Armchair Adventure.
Fantastic. And do you know that my favourite part about that is, so Ross is a, I think, sports science.
Yes, sports science
guy
graduate.
Who studied at Loughborough. And the guy's an absolute beast. When you look at him, you wouldn't think he could swim a couple of lengths of the pool, let alone around the UK. And
no,
that's exactly what people told him before he undertook this.
Yeah.
Incredible story. We don't want to ruin it. So get out there. Get a load of that book because it is massive.
Yes.
Okay. So as I was trying to say before, I was going to say, you don't have to undertake such huge things as Our Big Adventure or the or Ross Edgeley's mammoth swim around the UK. But we are going to keep it aquatic. And this week's weekend win is wild swimming.
Yes.
So the challenge is to get somewhere and do a bit of swimming, which isn't in a swimming pool. Rivers, lakes, the sea. Lee and I used to open water swim down in Newquay when we were living there, and it was one of the most amazing things. We've had some incredible experiences with particularly with the local seals whilst out swimming, and since then it's something I've always taken the opportunity to do whenever I can, is get into a river or a lake or just somewhere that isn't your normal run of the mill up and down swimming pool full of chlorine. So there we go. That's the challenge for this episode. Go and get a snap of you doing a bit of wild swimming. If you want to know how to go about it or a little bit more, you can visit www.wildswimming.co.uk and they've got loads of information and sites where you can go and enjoy this incredible activity. There's also the local Facebook pages. Join a wild swimming Facebook page in your area and you'll get loads and loads of advice. But please, 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 please be safe, people. We want people to experience it, but we want them to experience it safely. So all the information from earlier on in the podcast about water safety, have a think about it before you go dipping your toe into the cold water. And that brings us to the end of this podcast. I want to take the opportunity again to thank everybody that's been listening so far. Please tell your friends, write a review, get a review onto the whatever platform you're listening on, and that way we can expand our listener base and hopefully in the future have a little bit more content for you. We'd like to do this a bit more, I think.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, you can also join the Facebook group, Mud Island Adventures. Check us out on Instagram and on Twitter, and just generally have a great time. And from Lee and I for this week, all we have to say is go, do, and then tell us about it.